Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This episode of Groundwire was produced by 94.9 CHRW on the traditional territory of the Oneida and Chippewa of the Thames. We're your hosts, Weenie Lambrink
and Richard Raycraft.
In this episode, Vancouver's transit referendum fails to pass. A class action lawsuit is launched against Quebec's largest cable provider, and the City of London inside workers go on strike for 8 weeks before reaching a tentative deal with the city, with implications for municipalities across the country.
But first, here are the headlines.
The Pan Am Games have kicked off in Toronto. Like many big sporting events, they have displaced and marginalized some of the most vulnerable communities in the downtown core, with sex workers increasingly targeted by police. JL brings us this headline.
The People's Social Forum in Toronto last weekend featured two workshops on sex workers' justice. Community organizer Kate Zen examined what intersectional and queer trans people of color grassroots sex workers organizing looks like here and in the Global South. Kate also collaborated with other panelists Akio Maroon, Abuzer Chowdhury, and Nicole D. McFadyen to talk about the harms of the anti-trafficking movement, particularly in relation to large sporting events such as the Pan Am Games. According to non-profit anti-trafficking organizations such as the Canadian Baptist Women of Ontario, sporting events like the Pan Am Games are associated with massive increases in human trafficking to meet increased demand for paid sex. However, migrant sex workers and allies are resisting these narratives that moralize sex work, paint sex workers as victims, and conflate migration with trafficking. In collusion with anti-trafficking organizations, an increase in police surveillance and enforcement of Bill C-36 during the Pan Am Games has severe consequences for migrant, racialized, trans, and street-based sex workers. There is little evidence that sex workers are actually helped by interventions by police or nonprofits. Instead, they face deportation, harassment, and a decrease in business quality and quantity. This has been JL reporting for Groundwire.
There is currently a Canadian Union caravan traveling across Canada from Newfoundland to the West Coast, organizing against the cuts to postal services. Thunder Bay is one of many communities scheduled to lose its door-to-door postal service. Carly Forbes has the headline.
From 2013 to 2018, Canada Post has a five-year plan to convert 5 million homes from door-to-door postal service to community mailboxes. The conversion to community mailboxes is to be implemented in Thunder Bay in the summer of 2016. A town hall meeting was held to engage residents of Thunder Bay with the cuts facing the community on July 16th, with over 200 residents in attendance. Joanne Noasad, Thunder Bay local president of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, spoke about how these cuts are being made despite the fact that Canada Post continues to be a profitable business.
With the five-point plan, they based it upon the Conference Board report, which said that they would lose money from 2012 on. However, in the last several years, they haven't lost any money. In fact, they've made money. I believe at this point, they're up to $22 million for the first quarter of this year. Last year, they made $194 million in tax. So they're not losing money, and yet they're determined to cut the home delivery service. And we're saying that's wrong. This is a public service. They shouldn't be cutting it. We've also talked about postal banking, which would be lucrative for the post office, and that's been done in other countries. And again, Canada Post chose not to. So the public was quite interested and quite responsive. And they're saying, no, we don't want home delivery cut. Canada Post had, by invitation only, 46 meetings across Canada, and what they were meetings for small business owners. So they didn't have the input of the general public. You know, there were some points made where, you know, maybe they could have cut the service by one day or things like that. But again, Canada Post chose not to talk to the public. The two owners of Canada Post.
Joanne went on to talk about some of the issues that have arisen in communities that have already been converted to community mailboxes.
What they found is that the litter is just beyond control. So what they've had to do is set up recycle bins, which is costing the city and the taxpayers money. And Canada Post refuses to foot the bill for that. There's also lots of vandalism. There's more vandalism than ever. There's theft. So these are other concerns, and that's what, you know, some of the people were voicing, that they were concerned about, you know, the theft of mail. Because, you know, it's this day and age with identity theft and everything else.
I'm Carly Forbes, reporting for Groundwire from Anishinaabe Territory at CILU in Thunder Bay.
On July 16, Black Lives Matter Toronto attended a public board meeting of the Toronto Police Services. They came to the meeting with a list of demands in the wake of the murder of Andrew Lou Koo, a refugee from South Sudan. In a press release by Black Lives Matter Toronto, several unmet demands were read aloud during the board meeting. Their demands included laying charges against and releasing the names of the officers involved, a public apology by the mayor and chief of police to the family, and monetary compensation for the family, including the costs of the funeral. Black Lives Matter Toronto is also demanding the recommendations made by the African Canadian Legal Clinic be implemented. This includes a systemic inquiry by the Office of the Independent Police Review Director to gauge whether there has been adequate disciplinary action taken against officers who use force against Black people living with mental health issues, body cameras to be worn by all police officers, the release of data on the number of SIU cases involving racialized people and racialized people living with mental health issues, and an inquiry by the Ontario Human Rights Commission into the disproportionate use of force used against Black people with mental health challenges. Black Lives Matter says they will continue to take action until these demands are met, with a day of action planned for July 27th. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Walking around at 6 in the morning, sun soaks the street, and bluebirds are calling. I feel like I haven't slept for days.
Just heard I Won't by Ivory Hours.
Now it's time for our feature stories. The recent transit referendum failed to pass in Vancouver. Megan Thomas from CJSF in Burnaby, BC brings an in-depth discussion of the recent referendum.
On July 2nd, the BC Lower Mainland saw the release of the results of the 2015 Metro Vancouver Transportation and Transit plebiscite. In 2014, the Metro Vancouver Mayor's Council put forward an investment plan which outlined transportation infrastructure and strategies that they felt would best benefit the region. The province of BC established that funding for the Mayor's Council transit plan would be put to a non-binding plebiscite to determine the opinions of voters. The specific question was, do you support a new 0.5% Metro Vancouver congestion improvement tax to be dedicated to the Mayor's Council's transportation and transit plan? Of the approximately 760,000 votes, 61.68% voted no to paying the tax. Generally, the official yes campaign centered on the necessity for funding to accommodate the 1 million residents projected by Metro Vancouver to join the area by 2041. Generally, the no campaign was centered against a tax increase to fund the plan. In general, the referendum and ongoing discussion around it reflected, to varying degrees, a complex net of issues facing Metro Vancouver and BC in regards to transportation planning and public funding. Here are excerpts from a conversation between CJSF and two students of urban geography and planning about their votes and reactions to the results. Eric Doherty is a transportation planner who campaigned with the yes vote in the recent plebiscite, is educated in geography and urban planning at Simon Fraser University and the University of BC, leads transportation planning for Tanker Free BC, and operates as EcoPath Planning.
My primary point of view on it is that we've got a provincial government that really wants to push forward with a highways and freeways and highway bridge agenda, which funded through regressive taxation, that really is the most regressive possible outcome. And the fact is that what was on the table, while not perfect as a package of transit improvements, it seemed to be pretty darn good by North American standards. It's what was there, and we didn't really have, unfortunately, we really didn't have much of an opportunity to put an even more progressive and more aggressive transit package on the point of view that really gets where we need to be going as far as climate justice.
Elsewhere in their conversation, Doherty also noted that while he agrees the tax was regressive, he felt there were enough mechanisms to offset this effect for users. Andrew Longhurst is the former host of The City on CITR and CJSF, is an SFU MA geography candidate while also pursuing a PhD, whose research focuses on suburban poverty and the politics of policy. He voted no in the recent plebiscite, citing issues not only with the proposed funding model, but with the democratic value of the plebiscite and transportation and environmental governance in BC in general.
I'm really sympathetic to all of the arguments that Eric made, and I think he made them very well. So I'll preface it by saying that, and I think, you know, in that way, it was a very difficult decision to make, and one that I didn't take lightly. But a lot of it comes from a real frustration that I think in many ways this was a referendum question that was approved by the provincial government and really designed to fail because it would be so hard to sell it would be hard for local governments to make the case and sell it and try to get that yes vote out. And I think in many ways that's what we've seen. And I think it also reflects the provincial government not wanting to use what seems to be a democratic sort of initiative to sort of dodge the question, not have to take responsibility for funding public services. And I think largely my frustration is that it is, like you said, it is a regressive tax. It disproportionately burdens lower income people with a 0.5% increase in the sales tax, which is flat. And there was no really, I thought, robust discussion about what a rebate might look like or what something might look like to counteract that if we were going to go down that road of having an increase in the sales tax.
For Groundwire, I'm Megan Thomas, CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, on unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, Stolo, and Squamish nations. You can listen to the full conversation with Eric Doherty and Andrew Longhurst on SFU Ideas and Issues podcast via cjsf.ca or soundcloud.com/CJSF.
City of London inside workers took to the picket lines for 8 weeks as the city and the local Canadian Union of Public Employees 101 struggled to reach an agreement. A tentative agreement has been reached since the making of this feature. The details are not yet publicly available, but the implications of the deal are enormous. This feature was produced by CHRW with me, Richard Raycraft, and Andy Goddard.
QP workers under attack. What do we do?
Early on the morning of July 9th, the Canadian Union of Public Employees 101 and its supporters picketed London City Hall in the pouring rain. At the time, 750 City of London inside workers had been on strike for 7 weeks. As of this broadcast, the strike enters its 9th week.
A media blackout is currently in effect as city management and the union continue negotiations. In the days leading up to the picket, negotiations broke down because of issues surrounding weekend work. The city wants to expand working hours to the weekend, but QP 101 is resisting. At the most recent bargaining talk fallout, the city reportedly proposed hiring part-time and contract workers to fill weekend shifts not covered by full-time employees.
London and District Labour Council President Paddy Dalton, marching in solidarity with the picketers, expressed her disgust at this proposal.
We think that the city negotiating team has been shameful. Their conduct from the beginning of these negotiations has been shameful. And then in addition to that, in week 7 of this strike, they put major new items on the bargaining table. That is not collective bargaining in good faith. That is completely unacceptable.
The city suggests there's been a misunderstanding, but QP 101 President Shelley Navaroli isn't convinced.
Well, I'm not sure how there could be a misunderstanding. The document was given to us. It was written in plain English. Words were printed in black and white. There could be no misinterpretation for what we read. We feel that we're being treated unfairly. No other employee group is having to see the attacks that we are seeing. There are still no explanations as to why they are seeking the things that they are, such as the expanded hours of work. We've not had problems with that in the past. It's totally unacceptable.
The strike is the first by inside city workers in over 3 decades. On the picket lines, workers receive $300 in weekly strike pay compared to an average of $1,100 while working. Some bring their children as a symbol of the toll the work stoppage has had on their families, but hope is in short supply. Despite over a month of negotiating, the sides seem no closer to a deal. Weekend work is only one of the issues. There is also the matter of pay and expanded work hours during the week.
Western political science professor Andrew Sancton says the inside workers' strike has not affected day-to-day services in London, such as garbage collection and transportation, and this likely works to the city's advantage.
The city has tried hard with their own managers to cover for some of these jobs, and some of the work is being done, but I think it's pretty clear that some people are being inconvenienced. But the vast majority of people aren't being inconvenienced, and that is a problem, I'm sure, from the union's point of view.
While the union may not have a bargaining advantage, they do have the support of several other unions and groups in the local community.
We have about 20,000 affiliate union members in this city, and you've got our help! We've got your back! You wanted to fight along, take the OSFCF teachers, take the ESPO teachers, my op crew members, we're all in bargaining! And we're all facing the same austerity-style type crap from these governments. They think they can hand it down to us, and we're not going to take it anymore.
No way!
My name is Len Elliott. I'm with OPSU, and I'm a board member with OPSU.
OPSU is the Ontario Public Service Employees Union.
I think what they're realizing is that there's solidarity amongst the city. You saw some community folks that aren't unionized. You saw different unions around the city from Labour Council, etc. But what they have to understand is the austerity agenda is over. 2008 was a global economic crisis, and yet it continues today, 7 years later.
QP 101 is grateful for the support of its union allies across the province and country, support that was on full display at the picket.
Well, what we saw here today was yet another show of support and solidarity from the labor groups across London, organized by the London and District Labor Council, as well as community groups coming out to support QP Local 101 in our fight with the City of London to get a fair collective agreement.
Fair deal or not, the city's demand to increase working hours for its employees to include longer days as well as weekend work could send waves across the country.
It is a mystery not just from within London, the London context, but from within Canadian municipal government generally. Maybe people in London and the management side are trying to sort of carve out a new initiative that other municipalities will follow, but as far as I know, it isn't something that's been a big issue elsewhere.
So it's almost, there's a possibility this could be precedent setting in a way, if this is really kind of the first time this has happened.
If I'm right on that, then that certainly explains why the union is taking a tough position, because, you know, they wouldn't want this to be used as a precedent if they end up conceding to the city's position.
For CHRW, I'm Richard Raycraft.
And I'm Andy Goddard.
Up next, CKUT Radio in Montreal reports on a class action lawsuit launched to hold Quebec's largest cable provider accountable for not providing community access TV.
On July 14th, in downtown Montreal, Independent Community Television and André Desrochers, a Videotron subscriber, launched a class action lawsuit at the Quebec Superior Court on behalf of Videotron consumers and Greater Montreal residents. This collective action stems from Videotron's two decades of non-compliance with the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, or CRTC, regulations governing the operations of a community television license. This past February, the CRTC ruled on a complaint launched by ICTV with the support of hundreds of interveners, stating that MaTV, Videotron's community access TV channel, had failed in its obligations under the CRTC's regulations, including failing to meet requirements for community access, local content, and representation of Montreal's diverse communities. ICTV announced during Tuesday's press conference that they are demanding Videotron refund cable subscribers for the past 3 years of contribution to MaTV for the channel's failure to deliver community access TV. They are also asking for damages for breach of charter rights for not equitably representing Montreal's diverse communities through MaTV's programming, and moral and punitive damages for breaches of laws and regulations concerning consumer protection and community TV licenses. Lorraine Gay, a member of ICTV's board and longtime grassroots activist in Montreal, spoke about the history and reason for the class action suit.
La vigilance du CRTC dans ce dossier démontre que les consommateurs et consommatrices ont payé Vidéotron.
Lorraine speaks of the CRTC's diligence in exposing that consumers have paid Vidéotron for a service that was not delivered by Quebec's largest cable provider. She also expresses hope that ICTV's class action will raise public awareness of the miserable status of community TV in Canada. Lorraine also believes this class action is a chance to embolden the CRTC and their work to protect consumer rights, access to community TV, and media literacy for all of Canada and Quebec. Vidéotron responded to the class action lawsuit with a brief statement saying that MaTV is a community channel and its programming has always revolved around the interests of the local communities it serves. CKUT also spoke with diverse members of ICTV's board for their reaction to the press conference. Stéphane Bertrand, a community media activist working in community radio and Montreal's disability community, including serving as an ICTV board member, addresses the need for nonprofit community access television in Montreal.
I think it's time, like, Vidéotron give the community TV to the community, not to the letting all these big professional people doing what's there for the community.
CKUT asked Dolores Chu, a community activist in Montreal and president of ICTV's board, about the lack of representation of Montreal's diverse communities in the media landscape.
This is a great moment for us because we feel for a long time community representation in the media is very, very minuscule, and particularly in media that should be working for community, it's been fairly absent. So we're very excited about this, and we're hoping that there will be a positive outcome and that the CRTC will take note of our concerns.
Joneed Khan, a member of ICTV's board representing independent journalists, spoke about the strength of the class action lawsuit to hold Vidéotron accountable for not providing community access television in Montreal.
What I can say is that MaTV, in fact, is not a real community TV, as per the definition of the CRTC. It is usurping the title of community TV, and the idea that what we need under CRTC specifications, community TV for the community, by the community, I think that gives great validity to the class action suit.
With this class action lawsuit, ICTV seeks to empower Montreal's diverse communities to join in advocating for community TV by and for the community. Visit tele1.ca to join this collective fight to change community TV in Montreal.
That's tele1.ca for more information on the class action lawsuit to hold Vidéotron accountable for not providing community access TV. Thanks to CKUT for reporting for Groundwire from Joe Jagay, otherwise known as Montreal.
Now it's time for our community radio report.
The Indie Media Africa Working Group is a network of community media makers who are hosting a six-day grassroots media development workshop in Accra, Ghana, from August 4 to 10.
The Grassroots Media Network is working with the National Campus and Community Radio Association to help send a delegate from an African country as well as one from Canada to attend the workshops and represent at the World Association of Community Radio's General Assembly from August 10 to 15.
We're asking those interested in supporting this grassroots community-driven initiative to donate even just $5 to help make this amazing opportunity happen. Donations could be made via our Indiegogo campaign or PayPal at www.imc.ncra.ca. That is imc.ncra.ca. mtv.ca. Please help make this amazing opportunity a reality and support the world movement of community radio. Thank you.
CKUT's Yaffa, the 9-year-old host of The Friday Morning After, interviewed Sphinx, an independent community media organizer, about the independent media conference happening in Accra, Ghana, from August 10th to 14th, and the solidarity fundraising campaign the National Campus and Community Radio Association is participating in.
People call me Sphinx. I am an independent media organizer. I've been doing indie media since 2000. I do my focus mainly in Africa. I'm originally from Cameroon. That's in West Africa. And, so I'm excited to be on your show to talk about our upcoming Indie Media Africa Convergence that will be in Accra from August.
So, what's this campaign all about?
Yes. So, basically the effort is to help build community-owned and operated media capacity and infrastructure. What has been the practice in the last couple of years is that we've seen huge international donor organizations try to literally appropriate the space that has been opened by organizers, and this has been very counterproductive. So we're trying to counter that experience by building community-owned infrastructure, media infrastructure, which in the case of Africa is mainly radio, because one in every four Africans have access to radio, but basically one in every 160 Africans have access to the internet, which is probably the most used medium in the global north. So this whole effort is to try to build community-owned radio, and also we also have other internet communication technologies that we add to that to make the process better, that communities can get to use the radio more efficiently in a participatory manner.
Can you talk about the campaign and how does it work?
Okay. So one of, just like I was saying before, we are trying to network with the NCRA, that's the National Association of Community Radio, the National Campus and Community Radio Association of Canada. The idea is that there are two levels to this relationship. We're trying to build a long-term relationship as part of this global solidarity network and networking of people who do community media and radio in particular. But also, we're hoping to tap a lot from the experience that the NCRA has, or the community of stations around the NCRA has, in this respect of campus community relationship, which is pretty new for us, like I said before. So at this point in the Canada part of this outreach effort is being run by the NCRA. They put up a website called imcncra.ca. There they try to, you know, reach out to their various stations, to various communities around Canada, so people could help fund a Canadian delegate to participate at the convergence in Accra. But also in the process, as part of this international effort of solidarity between organizers in the global north and in the global south, that part of the funding that will be raised will go to cover the cost of an African delegate that they can get to participate because of the difficulties we have a little bit in the continent, in Africa, in fundraising locally. So that's been the focus, this two double relationship. One, we hope that we're going to be able to get someone from Canada to share with us at the convergence the experience that you people have in this campus community radio work, which is, we think, is very exciting. It opens a lot of possibilities for young people especially, but also for a space. It creates this space, this public space, right? This is in campuses where young people are always coming in and out. And also it diversifies the whole concept of engaging the community. So that's the part of this work from the Canadian side is being taken care of the NCRA.
So for more information about the Ghana Convergence and to donate to the NCRA's solidarity fundraising campaign, go to tinyurl.com/NCRA-Indiegogo.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CHRW on the traditional territory of the Oneida and Chippewa of the Thames. Music this week was by Ivory Hours. Headlines this week were written by JL and Carly Forbes. We also thank Megan Thomas, Yaffa, and Gretchen King. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download it at groundwire.ncra.ca.
Groundwire is a project of the members of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.